Funds for this program were provided by the Missouri Arts Council. KWMU presents Literary Profiles, Part 5, William Gass. William Gass was born in Fargo, North Dakota in 1924 and was educated at Kenyon College, Ohio Wesleyan, and Cornell, where he received his Ph.D. He is currently professor of philosophy at Washington University. Gass is the author of 7 books of fiction and nonfiction, including Omensetter's Luck and In the Heart of the Country. You write in the preface to in the Heart of the Country that your first creative impulse came at around 8.
Yeah, that's right.
Was that poetic?
Yes, it was. It was doggerel poetry. I think, in fact, the first poem I wrote, or so it's alleged by my family, was a temperance poem against drinking beer. I think that's true. But I was writing poetry, and I did write poetry as a kid, and almost no prose until I was in high school. That impulse was very strong. But I was terrible. And I began to realize that even at an early age. So the poetry sort of flopped out and became prose poetry a la Whitman, and then finally became prose, and a good thing, too.
Were books a big part of your family?
No, though my father was a teacher. He taught mechanical drawing. There was a lot of magazines and junk in the house of that sort, but not a great many books or any interest in music or painting or any of that. To some of that, serious music, for example, I came quite late. But I was a voracious reader anyhow, and I read everything I could get my hands on. Libraries are wonderful things, and pocketbooks were just beginning. And so every Saturday, a quarter went to a pocketbook that just came out, many of which I still have, and I sort of treasure as mementos of those days. That paper didn't rot. It's still alive.
Mm-hmm. So was the inspiration from reading?
I don't know. The idea that you want to be a writer comes that early. It's hard to tell where it comes from. There was nothing in my background and so on. But that determination nevertheless was there and never changed, really. It certainly was fueled by that. I mean, I read people and I wanted to be somebody who wrote things like that. And in that sense, certainly it got... But I was a slow reader at the beginning, first few years of my schooling, I guess, very slow, and then suddenly took off. And I'm not sure, what it was that implanted this idea. Certainly by the time I was in high school, I had it all, as kids do, thinking they have control of their lives, worked out. I was going to study philosophy and teach and then write on. That was the idea.
You consider yourself a writer rather than a philosopher?
Oh, I'm not a philosopher at all. I teach philosophy, which is quite a different thing. Being a philosopher is terribly difficult and quite beyond me. Philosophy is one of the more difficult things, I think, to do in the world. If you have 3 or 4 or 5 wonderful philosophers in a century, you call it the age of the Enlightenment. No, that's much too hard. Just think about the number of great philosophers and put it alongside the number of novelists. Well, there are lots of famous novelists and very few philosophers. But it's a wonderful subject to talk about because it's made to be talked about. I don't think literature is made to be talked about, only it gets talked about, but it's made to be experienced, whereas philosophy is constructed for talk and inquiry and debate and so on.
I think that you are rare, you certainly are, but there are, I think before, in past centuries particularly, that a writer was expected to know philosophy and that there are not too many who pursue it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly true in an American tradition. It's an anti-intellectual society and always has been, and the writers were not intellectuals by and large. There's a little in the Emerson tradition that's not quite true. It's still overflow there from the European, where a man or woman of letters was expected to be able to write intelligently on almost any subject that wasn't too technical. The fact that someone might be a novelist or poet and a trained thinker, historian, philosopher, or whatever, in Europe is commonplace. But in the United States, except for that early Emersonian transcendentalism, it was, by and large, literature fell into the two camps of the Gothic, Baroque thing where you get Melville through Faulkner, and the manners of Hawthorne through James. And in those types of work, ideas are very suppressed. They are there, they're important, but they're not discussed openly or directly. Nowadays, that's changed. The American novelists are much more philosophically oriented. Many of them have some training. The international influence is predominant, so that you really have now a third strain, the so-called intellectual novel or novel of ideas, which was, you know, common in England and in Europe.
I suppose the people who go to Harvard and perhaps to Washington University and these other schools mm-hmm. will take a course of study called liberal arts, mm-hmm. which I think is far from the liberal arts maybe as Emerson.
Oh, certainly.
Saw it.
Yeah. Well, it's much more specialized. You're allowed to be ignorant of a lot of things, indeed. That ignorance is courted. And it is extremely difficult these days to manage what earlier periods, always in history, found much more possible, and that is to have some grip on the general knowledge of things. Probably Aristotle was the last to be able to really make such a claim. And now it gets very difficult. You either tend to be a narrow specialist, even in the humanities, or a sloppy and superficial generalist of who has no sense of the depth of subjects, which is disastrous. So ideally what one has to do is to have at least one subject at which you're really an expert, so you know what depth in a subject is, and then enough broadness to know where your subject belongs. But it's very difficult to manage both of those things. It's a lifetime's occupation.
You have one quote I like that's sort of pertinent to that. Literature once held families together better than quarreling.
Oh, yeah. Well, people used to, of course, sit around and read the Bible aloud. We tend to forget now, since we neither read it nor read it aloud much, is that a great part of American literature was formed, the ear was formed, the style was formed by that tradition of biblical reading. The King James Version is fundamental to American literature in that sense. It's all through Faulkner, of course. But that tradition, of course, is dying out, and so is the tradition then of hearing the word. One now sees the word on television or billboards or newspapers or whatever, and the notion of hearing is really disappearing from at least my students. I regret that, but I think it's inevitable.
William Gass published his first novel in 1966. Owen Setter's Luck received much critical acclaim. Here is William Gass reading from Omen Setter's Luck.
It has to do with a parallel between the character here, Henry Pimber, and Adam's naming the animals and plants when God gives Adam, in effect, that privilege. The path took Henry Pimber past the slag across the Meadow Creek, where his only hornbeam hardened slowly in the southern shadow of the ridge, and the trees of the separating wood began in rows as the lean road in his dream began, narrowing to nothing in the blank horizon, for train rails narrow behind anybody's journey. And he named them as he passed them, elm, oak, hazel, larch and chestnut tree, as though he might have been the fallen Adam passing them and calling out their soft, familiar names, as though familiar names might make some friends for him by being spoken to the unfamiliar and unfriendly world which he was told had been his paradise. In God's name, when was that? When had that been? For he had hated every day he'd lived. Ash, birch, maple. Every day he thought would last forever, and the night forever, and the dawn drag eternally another long and empty day to light forever. Yet they sped away the day, the night clicked past as he walked by the creek, by the hornbeam tree, the elders, sorrels, cedars, and the fir. For as he named them, sounding their soft names in his lonely skull, the fire of fall was on them, and he named the days he'd lost. It was still sorrowful to die. Eternity for them had ended, and he would fall when it came his time, like an unseen leaf, the bud that was the glory of his birth, forgot before remembered. He named the aspen, beech, and willow, and he said aloud the locust when he saw it leafless like a battlefield. In God's name, when was that? When had that been?
It must have been quite a thrill with the first novel to have created such a stir.
Well, it was a surprise. Yeah. Actually, the stir, you know, was in a teacup, a tepid tea in a dirty finger. It was a surprise because I had a terrible time getting the book published and so on, and then it did receive very nice critical notices, and it was widely reviewed. It wasn't read, but it was, you know, that was very, very surprising, and I was very grateful.
A novel that is difficult but worthy of the effort.
Well, one hopes. All good books are difficult. They just sometimes look a little easier. And that can even be dangerous. One of my favorite writers, Colette, and Colette is easy to read in one sense, but not real Colette. It's easy to skate across Colette and miss it and read it like any sort of high school girl romance or something. And it's not like that at all, really. And a terribly wonderful and disturbing and beautiful writer. And so that kind of effort which you have to make to get into Colette and not allow yourself to simply to be swept away into a pretty story. In other work, much of contemporary work, you're stopped right in your tracks by Beckett and you crawl through the mud as his characters do. So you know you're right there. The same thing happens, though, with Plato. You know, you can scoot along the top of Plato and enjoy this and miss so much else. With Kant, it's all bottom.
William Gass's latest work is a book of essays entitled Habitations of the Word. Essays in general I used to think that poetry was the most ignored of all the of all writing, and perhaps essays are even more ignored. What do you think?
Oh yes, I think so. In our society, the people who produce short pieces of prose write articles. The essay is far too undisciplined and literary a form for the magazines who want articles and so forth. And it is a hybrid form. It's, I think, had its glorious practitioners in our tradition, but has never had the interest and excitement of the readers of even the short story or poetry. I suppose people read more essays now than they read poetry because hardly anybody reads poetry at all anymore. But still, it's not very greatly demanded.
Simply because there isn't a forum and because we don't read much as we used to anyway.
We don't like to take time out to meditate. An essay is something that allows the mind to simply toy with an idea and wander around in it. We're either laying out some sort of set of facts and arguments as if we were doing it in concrete and calling it an article, or we're writing something fictional. With the essay, you're really looking at ideas the way you might look at scenery. You appreciate them. You're not quite so concerned to get everything right or to prove something, but to enjoy. And we've lost the capacity to enjoy a lot of things. We're so busy going to the movies and the ballpark and so on, to really take a stroll through parts of the mind and areas of feeling. We don't do that very much, and that's what the essay really allows you to do, and one of the reasons I enjoy it so much. Walter Benjamin, who is a European essayist of great quality, was also what is called a flaneur, a stroller, an idler on the avenues, and that's what an essayist ideally, I think, is.
I wonder, though, how it's a broader question about anything that you write, but I wonder how you defend, as Socrates might have, what it was that he was trying to teach, what it is that you do. I suppose poets do it all the time. If you don't have a large audience, is it something that you have to do and that you will get a small audience and you always know that?
Oh, yes. This doesn't trouble me at all. I know a lot of my friends who write novels that nobody reads and poetry that has disappears and so forth, as far as readers are concerned, are upset very frequently. I was reconciled to that at very early. Partly it has to do with my attitude toward popular culture in this country, which I rather generally despise, and to that extent to be popular or widely read would be a serious criticism of the quality of your work. And so my defense, if you like, is that if you're going to be any good, you can't have an audience. Now, you might be very bad and have no audience, too. It's not a sufficient condition. But it's certainly a necessary one. It's almost a rule that the wider your audience, the poorer the work. And that's a sad thing, of course, but doesn't do much good, I think, to fuss about it, to worry about it, or try to change it, because it's not changeable. But there's also another aspect that is positive about it, and that is when you're not widely read and do not have a lot of influence, you also don't have the burden of responsibilities which, say, a Chinese writer or a Russian writer or even someone like Sartre, who is looked to direct the mind of many people. And I would be terrified by that prospect. I think I'd just shut up. I mean, if I thought people were really paying attention and saying, well, Gas says so-and-so, so we have to, you know, do something. That frees you then to say what you think and to, in a sense, have a good time and to explore and experiment. That absence of responsibility may produce, some people think, a lack of seriousness, but I doubt it.
I'm interested, though, in why you were drawn to philosophy.
Well, I think partly because philosophy, in a way, does something that the novelist does, but at an abstract level. The philosopher creates a picture, a theoretical structure of the world. What the novelist tends to do is to create a world through data, details, facts, which are then linked in such a way that we can infer the philosophical, scientific grounding of it. But the philosopher, of course, his aim explicitly is to get it right. But we know that they don't get it right. Not all philosophers can be right because they contradict one another. And probably my suspicion is that most are quite wrong. However, the systems which are built are quite extraordinary and wonderful. And at a certain point, doesn't matter whether they're mistaken. In that sense, there's a lot of connection between philosophical systems and fictional work. It's two ways of making a world, one by designing its laws and the other by imagining its events.
I think that the very greatest books do have philosophy in them. And you've just explained that you can infer these things in the books. But I think it's possible to make a philosophy as well in a novel.
Oh, you can do anything. I mean, you can, first of all, you can, in fact, just create a character who talks and expounds a philosophy, or a character who writes one. Or you can design deliberately. You can have digressions. Tolstoy does this in War and Peace on A Theory of History. Melville wants to stop and talk about whales for a while. He stops and talks about whales. Of course, when I say you can do anything in a novel, I mean that you have ultimately to find a form which will justify doing that. But it allows initially the entrance of any kind of device. Or you can submerge it. You can have a surface and a series of events that seem as far from an ideology or a philosophical framework as possible, but then looking at that world as it is created, the way we might look at our own, we can infer a philosophical system. And what's often interesting and frequently happens is that the novelist's conscious philosophical ideas, which appear in the work perhaps, may even be too obvious and sort of preachy, are contradicted by the philosophical system implicit in the world which they construct. And that's very interesting sometimes when it happens.
We quote books as if they are philosophy as well.
Oh, yes, we often do, yes. I think that is largely either a social convenience or a mistake, because the book doesn't defend or prove. It shows. It can be very persuasive, but usually not rationally. So one has then to test that, what you get, what you come away with in a novel by Sartre or Camus or whoever. You better test. Now, of course, they often, because they're very philosophically inclined as well, will provide those tests, those schemes, those arguments independently, and you'll have two kinds of thing. a novel can be a very persuasive instrument and should, like all persuasive instruments, be looked at very suspiciously from the point of view of belief.
Speaking of being suspicious, I'd like to talk about the title essay of your book, Habitations of the Word, in which you discuss the Platonic dialogue, Phaedrus. Is it all that significant that this is the only Platonic dialogue that takes place outside the walls
of
Athens?
Yes, I think it is. I think the fact that Socrates is placed along the river and in this confine is very significant. In fact, as you look at those dialogues, especially in the middle period, as they're called, everything is significant. It's like a work of art in that sense. No detail is not operating. And the very movement of the whole discussion of where, in effect, the word comes from, the fact that it's moved outside town and that Socrates is a city person completely is important, I think, in terms of what Socrates then later goes on to develop in his speeches. In a society, of course, that Socrates is in, which is oral, and where almost all discussion and thought takes place verbally, then who is really speaking and what the origin and genuineness of that speech becomes enormously important. And what I think Plato perceived was that every word was, in sense, many words, and came from different parts of the self, and was therefore saying different things and had different aims depending on where it was from. And so certain words emerge from my mouth, for instance, and are heard by other people. But I am not just some simple organism from which the words emerge, so you can say, he said. I am a complex, almost city itself, and my words come from various places. And sometimes the same expression means one thing and sometimes another. And in the case of a word like love, the expression, I love you, well, if that is spoken by different organs of the body, it means different things. And to say, when the mind says, in Plato's sense, I love you, that implies a judgment of excellence and quality, whereas if it's desire that's speaking, it may mean merely lust. So you have all of these things, yet the words are the same. And I think Plato saw how important it was that we know what words or where the words are coming from in order to understand what they mean and in order to understand who is to be trusted. And who is rational and so forth. And I think that's a still profoundly true.
But also, doesn't it sort of come down to that that word means all those things all at once?
Yes.
As well?
Sure, it can, or it can. Plato was very, would have liked to have cleaned up the language so that people would communicate largely by means of using the word as it stood for the rational meanings. That was, of course, a dream, and Plato knew it was a dream, but it was his dream. And we always have these extremes, but by and large, and much of the time, it is all mixed up together, and often very disorderly way. That's why the great image of the charioteer and the horses were pulling different directions in the chair's trying to get everything to go together. And Plato, of course, would have liked to see that. He would have liked to have had the word love mean, I judge you to be worthy of love, therefore I have the feeling of love for you, consequently I desire you, in that order. And so the words, then the expression, would mean all of those things in that order, logically arranged, and so on.
However, you have these irrational things.
Yes.
That make these this course and perhaps even the forms also irrational.
Yes, sure. And indeed, much of thinking becomes a rationalization. I desire you, therefore, I will find arguments why you are excellent, etc., so that the word good then will mean what I want and not the other way around. Plato thought we should desire what was good, whereas in fact we tend to call things good because we want them. And that division, of course, is fundamental in Platonic thought, and he was all on the side of reason, which of course now has a bad press.
A little background on the dialogue is that Phaedrus has been to hear an oration which he thinks is particularly beautiful and eloquent, mm-hmm. on love. And Socrates, as usual, wants to hear everything that happened, and Phaedrus not only can tell it but can recite it word, mm-hmm. for word. There, you know, there's always, too, when you set about to discuss Socrates, is that in a way Socrates never seems fully a man,
mm-hmm.
except, I think, in an Aristotelian sense, mm-hmm. he is. But in all the things that we learn about in the other dialogues, particularly the symposium, he doesn't, because he doesn't seem to ever come down to our level. Mm-hmm. But there's always a hint, and particularly with Phaedrus in this dialogue, whether Socrates is in love with Phaedrus,
mm-hmm.
Or in any of the other dialogues as well.
Early dialogues are much more earthy, much more full of circumstantial things, much more open about Socrates' own sexual interests and behavior. And then as Plato matures and the dialogues become more and more an instrument for Plato's own ideas, Socrates becomes more and more simply a spokesperson and more a abstraction, until finally in the late dialogues he disappears altogether. But Socrates himself, I think, especially as Plato in the earlier dialogues, even including some of the middle ones like the Symposium, develops, Socrates' language is, by and large, extremely earthy and direct. A great many of the translations, Jowett's famous ones, for example, clean this up for Victorian tastes, and indeed Christianize a lot of what Socrates is saying as well. Even now, it is hard to get translations of even some of the technical dialogues which render Plato's earthy speech, because they're embarrassed by it. Sometimes gutter talk, used in contexts of great philosophical interest. These words are translated in a almost neutral way. The fact is that Plato himself was he's a puritanical person, but he's ridden with sexual impulses, and all of his thought is colored by sexual imagery.
But also, I think it's the thing that makes Plato a poet, namely that kind of contrast.
Oh, I think he had one of the greatest ranges of diction, the most literary, abstract words, the most streetwise words, all and everything in between, in one single texture. Amazing, amazing style.
When you first started studying Plato, did he give you fits?
Plato was a total joy, I think. Aristotle gave me some fits. I love Aristotle, but Aristotle did. But from the first, and of course one reads Plato at level after level and so forth, but from the first I was absolutely transported by Plato, and I've never been disappointed in him for one moment since. He's endlessly wonderful. That's true, of course, as you get into, if you're studying Kant, the same. But Kant doesn't have that wonderful surface either, or that poetic impulse. But the very great philosophers, of course, are constant amazement. But Plato is, I think, for everybody in that sense, because you can get Plato at the most superficial level, and he's wonderful, and at the most profound level, and everything in between.
Did you study philosophy because you found it fascinating, or because you thought it would make you a better writer, or anything like that?
Well, I think it. I didn't quite have it that clear. I think, but what philosophy's aims are often are marvelous aims for a writer to have. The disciplines are different in the sense that just as there are many different meanings to the word love in Plato's dialogue, there are many different meanings to the word clarity, the word order, form, precision, integrity, and so forth. But in fact, the, say, ideals of a philosophical approach of trying to clear ideas up, not darken them, to argue and order and arrange a presentation of ideas in their proper, somehow, way, the same thing that the fiction writer wants to do in the sense that, that you're always trying to organize. You don't want to make obscure works. They may be complex, difficult. Kant is complex and difficult. And there are obscurities. No one's perfect. But he's basically trying to be clear, precise, and true. In fiction, you're trying to be coherent and careful and get everything in the right way. And those parallel aims then, I think, although they're realized differently in each. And studying philosophy really does help you realize what the advantages and greatness of clarity are.
When you first read The Republic, did you wonder how Plato the poet could ban his kind?
Yes, but early on I had a hunch about that. I think Plato was right in a way. I mentioned that earlier in saying we had to be on our guard about believing what fiction writers and indeed poets say, because their methods are not those of rational inquiry. And they are persuasive. And if we then allow the poets, by these methods, to persuade us, we're being what Plato called a sophist. And I think he's right, and I think we live in the age of sophists, advertisers, propagandists, and so on, are all after our minds, and we have to be very careful. I want to, again, to return to another thing we were talking about, the fact that novelists and poets are not much read and heeded in our country. Frees them from the job of being sophists and taking themselves seriously as wise people. They're no wiser than anybody else. You know, some are wise and some are not. But just because they're good novelists doesn't mean that. I know a number of fine novelists who are really rather dumb, you know. Doesn't matter. And some very bright people who are really second-rate novelists. I agree with Plato that I wouldn't ban them and kick them out of the Republic, of course. That part is. But his suspicion about them and their connection with the truth, I think, is well taken.
The novel that you're currently working on, or I assume still working on, The Tunnel, correct me if I'm wrong, surpassed Mr. Joyce in his writing of Finnegan's Wake. How many years has it
been? Well, it's coming along there. I started it, the initial notions started in 66. And it became a book that I could say had a title, certainly by 70, and so it's now been around a long time. My friend William Gaddis writes novels generally that take 20 years and so on, and this is seemingly about to do that. I'm nearly done now. Won't be long.
But in the meantime, you don't. There's this other volume of work that you write as well in between this book, namely the essays and things such as that.
You are
constantly
you can get
writing.
Them done.
The many introductions you write and all of these things. The tunnel, I've heard you speak about it before and I've heard you read from it, is you've said that the novel has to be rethought, that if you really want to write a novel, you've got to try to find a new way.
Suppose what happens, as we've been talking about it, suppose you don't really have an audience. Suppose you're not going to move the world. Suppose you could say anything you like and no one would put you in jail. No, nothing. Then what's the point? Well, the point is to advance the art. And that means that the book is itself an exploration, quite apart from, you know, the other things it may be doing too, but it's an exploration of the very art of fiction. And this is certainly not a new idea. I think every serious artist encounters this. It doesn't mean that every artist will pursue it. There are periods, particularly when a writer like Dryden, for instance, can take master forms and techniques that he didn't invent and simply perfect them. In that sense, he advances the art only by showing what a certain kind of form can marvelously do. But if you take someone like Beethoven, who has written many, say, quartets, and perfected quartets, in the late quartets, he must explode the quartet. Beethoven is the kind of artist who simply has to keep on pushing. And I think, particularly in our time, when you don't have an appreciative and vast audience to enjoy the perfections of a completely accomplished and serene, really, writer or musician who is in a world that they know and they've mastered, and here's another lovely piece, you know, that you kind of constantly push and shove. What else can be done? What more can we do? Because one is frequently reduced to that. But I think, too, as an artist matures, and this happens over and over again with even, say, writers or composers of great popularity, Verdi, for instance, that popularity and that appeal to the mass is seen to be hollow. And when it's seen to be hollow, the artist emerges as a conscious artist. Verdi's a kind of happy hack with genius, but for a long time. And then suddenly the late works begin to emerge. And at 70, he's starting. That's, I think, a great project. I mean, that way, too, you don't have to turn out another book that your audience liked and is looking forward to and wants more of the same. Then you're not starting, you're in retirement.
This is from In the Heart of the Heart of the Country, and this is the title, Story.
And it's broken up into sections, and here's one on weather. For we're always out of luck here. That's just how it is. For instance, in the winter, the sides of the buildings, the roofs, the limbs of the trees are gray. Streets, sidewalks, faces, feelings, they are gray. Speech is gray. And the grass where it shows. Every flank and front, each top is gray. Everything is gray. Hair, eyes, window glass, the hawkers' bills and touters' posters, lips, teeth, poles, and metal signs. They're gray, quite gray. Cars are gray. Boots, shoes, suits, hats, gloves are gray. Horses, sheep, and cows, cats killed in the road, squirrels in the same way, sparrows, doves, and pigeons, all are gray. Everything is gray, and everyone is out of luck who lives here. A similar haze turns the summer sky milky, and the air muffles your head and shoulders like a sweater you've got caught in. In the summer light, too, the sky darkens a moment when you open your eyes. The heat is pure distraction. Steeped in our fluids, miserable in the folds of our bodies, we can scarcely think of anything but our sticky parts. Hot cyclonic winds and storms of dust crisscross the country. In many places, given an indifferent push, the wind will still coast for miles, gathering resource and edge as it goes, cunning and force. According to the season, paper, leaves, field litter, seeds, snow fill up the fences. Sometimes I think the land is flat because the winds have leveled it, they blow so constantly. In any case, a gale can grow in a field of corn that's as hot as a draft from hell, and to receive it is one of the most dismaying experiences of this life, though the smart of the same wind in winter is more humiliating, and in that sense, even worse. But in the spring, it rains as well, and the trees fill with ice. I must organize myself. I must, as they say, pull myself together, dump this cat from my lap, stir. Yes, resolve, move, do. But do what? My will is like the rosy dust-like light in this room, soft, diffuse, and gently comforting. It lets me do anything. Nothing. My ears hear what they happen to. I eat what's put before me. My eyes see what blunders into them. My thoughts are not thoughts. They are dreams. I'm empty or I'm full, depending, and I cannot choose. I sink my claws in Tick's fur and scratch the bones of his back until his rear rises amorously. Mr. Tick, I murmur, I must organize myself. I must pull myself together. And Mr. Tick rolls over on his belly, all ooze. I spill Mr. Tick when I've rubbed his stomach. Shoo! He steps away slowly, his long tail rhyming with his paws. How beautifully he moves, I think. How beautifully, like you, he commands his loving. How beautifully he accepts. So I rise and wander from room to room, up and down, gazing through most of my 41 windows. How well this house receives its loving, too. Let out like Mr. Tick, my eyes sink in the shrubbery. I am not here. I've passed the glass, passed second-story spaces, flown by branches, brilliant berries to the ground, grass high in seed and leafage every season. And it is the same as when I passed above you in my aged, ardent body. It's, in short, a kind of love. And I am learning to restore myself, my house, my body, by paying court to gardens, cats, and running water, and with neighbors keeping company. Mr. Tick, you do me honor. You not only lie in my lap, but you remain alive there, coiled like a fetus. Through your deep nap, I feel you hum. You are, and are not, a machine. You are alive, alive exactly, and it means nothing to you, much to me. You are a cat. You cannot understand. You are a cat so easily. Your nature is not something you must rise to. You, not I, live in house, in skin, in shrubbery. Yes, I think I shall hat my head with a steeple, turn church, devour people. Mr. Tick, though, has a tail he can switch. He need not fly his fancy. Claws, not metrical schema, poetry his paws, while smoothing, smoothing, smoothing roughly, his tongue laps its neatness. Oh, Mr. Tick, I know you. You are an electrical penis. Go on now. Shoo.
William Gass, reading from his book of short stories, In the Heart of the Heart of the Country.
Sharpening the eye is a really difficult problem because what you have to do is look at the world, as a writer, that is, to look at the world so it gives you words. It isn't just simply the looking at the world the way the painter would, or it must give you words. Otherwise, although you might be seeing wonderfully, from the point of view of the writing at any rate, you're not seeing anything. Lately I have found, since I am a writer who constantly needs to be reminded to pay attention to something other than language, that camera work is very useful for me because it makes me look, and then I can take the images home and study them until they give me some words. I don't know how this will eventually work out, but I'm engaged in that kind of process now. Great work is there to be loved. Oh, but not everybody has to love everything. I mean, there are lovable people in the world, but we don't want everyone loving them. I mean, it's silly. I have a particular fondness. It's hardly that. It's an infatuation or obsession with the poet and novelist Rilke. And this came to me quite late. That is, I was in my late 20s before I really became devoted to his work. I can recommend to people, and I teach all the time, Rilke's work, but it would be not with the expectation that for most people, for instance, Rilke would have the meaning that's almost personal, almost alter ego, that he does for me. And again, sometimes we read people for a way of perceiving and a way of being that we can't manage, never could imitate, but just can admire. And I'm thinking both of the cat I just read from about, but Colette. The French don't appreciate Colette enough. One reason is she's a woman and she doesn't write with enough thorny abstractness. She's one of the finest writers I've ever encountered. And one of the things that I like about her is the feline grace. She has immense grace, and I cannot have it. And I, you know, read to see how that wonderful thing is done. And one could go on with enormous. I mean, another woman who has influenced me enormously is Gertrude Stein. She doesn't write like that at all. It's like a bunch of rocks in the road, you know. Wonderful intellect, an amazing presence, and it becomes, she's Gertrude to me. I live with Gertrude, you know. I talk to her, that sort of thing. But not everyone would, you know, go to her and even enjoy it. And there's no reason why we. The world is so big. Literature is so marvelous. I've been just finished a new book by William Gaddis, Carpenter's Gothic. I would just love to recommend. It's been a great year, if I get in my recommendations. A great year in fiction. It began with Stanley Elkin's new book, and then was followed by Carpenter's Gothic by Gaddis. John Hawkes has got a new book coming out, Adventures in the Alaskan Skin Trade, which is just sensational. And Robert Coover will have a book out in January, Gerald's Party, which is an incredible book. So that when you think of the writers that I admire here, all coming out almost, Barth hasn't got one out this year and so on, and they are books of outstanding quality. And people say, you know, nothing is happening in the novel. Everything is happening in it.
Literary Profiles, Part 5, William Gass, was produced by Lauren Cuoco. The associate producer was Sean Collins. This has been a production of KWMU St. Louis. Funds for this program were provided by the Missouri Arts Council.